You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, communities in Wisconsin are passing mask mandates as the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases increase statewide. We'll talk to a public health expert about the mandates and where the state stands in tackling the spread of the virus. Now, this month marks 30 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA. It was the first comprehensive civil rights law in the United States for people with disabilities. A new book shares stories from a number of authors, in part to mark that anniversary. It's called Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. The book's a collection of essays, testimonies, blog posts, manifestos, all written by people living with disabilities. Amanda Riom is a feminist activist and writer who contributed to the Disability Visibility anthology with her essay, Why My Novel is Dedicated to My Disabled Friend, Maddie. Amanda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Hi.
And Alice Wong is a disabled activist and the founder and director of the Disability Visibility Project. She's editor of the new book. Alice, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Alice, what inspired you to start gathering stories from people living with disabilities for your Disability Visibility Project?
Well, I think it started when I was really a young person. You know, I was more disabled. I knew that I was different from everybody else at a very young age. And I really didn't see or saw myself reflected much in books, film, television, you name it. And, you know, I thought that was normal. You know, I didn't realize that I was part of this larger history, this larger culture and community until I was a little bit older, let's say in my teenage and early adult years. So speaking of the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, I was a sophomore when it passed in 1990. And, you know, it's really changed a lot of lives. And by becoming connected to the disability community, as I got older, I just really became a fan. You know, I've read so many amazing books, essays, just tweets by disabled people. And I think at the heart of a lot of what I do is that, you know, I love to hype the work of other disabled artists, activists, and writers. And this is really just a collection of work that I feel like is speaking to the present in the terms of these are 21st century stories, which means they're published from the year 2000 to 2019.
Amanda, Alice talked about the importance of community. She writes about that also in her introduction. And the story you share in the book really speaks to that. Can you share some of your piece, Why My Novel is Dedicated to My Disabled Friend, Maddie? Talk about the relationship that inspired this piece.
Yeah, so unlike Alice, I became disabled about 3 years ago when I had a severe head injury that I had to learn how to kind of walk and talk again after that. And it's left me with a lot of severe impairments around fatigue, as well as a complication with using computer screens. Now, unfortunately, I was and still am a writer. And so writers need screens in order to write their work. So what happened after I was injured, I became really frustrated and a bit depressed because I was trying to finish a novel, which was basically done when I was injured. And I just didn't have the capacity to edit it on the screen. So I printed it out and was trying to edit it that way. But because of the visual impairments I have or visual processing issues I have, I couldn't then transfer the edit. So I thought I was doomed never to write again. But I ran into or I met a woman named Maddie who it turns out also had a head injury. And what was interesting about that is that we ended up figuring a way where we could help each other. Maddie was struggling to find full-time work because of her head injury. and needed some flexible part-time work, and I needed someone to help me transcribe my edits. And so that's essentially what Maddie did. And it's a really great metaphor for what a lot of people within the disability community like to talk about a lot, which is the fact that we are all far more interdependent than we like to think we are, even though disabled people are often more visibly interdependent or seen as interdependent by others, all of us experience different levels of interdependence, and none of us can actually survive without each other. So my story is really a beautiful story about disabled interdependence and community, in which two people with very similar but slightly different injuries were able to help each other not just achieve goals, but also heal in a lot of ways through community.
We're talking to Alice Wong and Amanda Riom about the new anthology called Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. Amanda was giving us a sense there of the diversity of stories also shared in this anthology. A lot of people with different kinds of disabilities and different backgrounds, sometimes being members of ethnic groups or having other things that that work with their disabilities to give them other challenges in life. Can you talk about the importance of representing this wide scope of experience here?
Well, I think that this is part of the thing that's really misunderstood about disability is that, you know, we exist in every single community, and that, you know, for a long time, I think the overall representation of disability, whether it's in history or popular culture, let's say, has been overwhelmingly white, and it's often focused on what we think of as apparent disabilities. But, you know, for example, somebody who uses sign language, a wheelchair user, somebody who might use a service animal. You know, the reality is it's much more broad and, you know, nuanced. There's a lot of people with non-apparent disabilities that are often just not represented or not even truly included. For example, you know, people with chronic illnesses, people with pain, you know, people with intellectual disabilities, people with mental health disabilities. There's a lot of people who are definitely considered, protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act that may never identify or say the word disabled, but, you know, they're definitely considered part of the community. At least that's my personal approach and my personal opinion. That's, you know, we need to make sure that people feel seen and heard, and that they don't have to use certain words, but that they're welcome into this very, you know, diverse and complicated, non-monolithic community.
And Amanda, Alice mentioned the public perception of people living with disabilities. And you talk about that a little in your piece. A lot of times the story is, I think, what some people call inspiration porn. There's this one person and they pull themselves up. They overcome the obstacles on their own through grit and gumption. And I think in your essay, you make the case, as you were saying earlier, it's more complicated than that. And it's more, again, more of a community approach than we sometimes see.
Yeah, and I've written about this elsewhere as well. So I was injured with a head injury. And so the idea is that we often think people recover, and we valorize stories when people recover. So what does that mean for people like me and like my friend Maddie, who don't recover, who have severe impacts? It often means that the way people perceive us is somehow deficient, in that we haven't tried enough to recover, or we haven't, or if we tried harder, we would recover in the future. So this whole idea of the super crip, which is often talked about, is kind of this narrative that's constructed. It's supposedly supposed to be fun and lovely to and heartwarming, but it actually serves to cause harm to a lot of disabled people. So I've experienced a lot of ableism. I have what's known as an invisible disability. So if you meet me, if you see me, there's nothing visible about me that's disabled, or that you would recognize as a disability, what we see as visible disabilities. But I could have severe symptoms right in front of you, and you wouldn't be able to know it. And so it's that disjunction between the lack of visibility and the fact that a lot of people end up not believing people who have invisible disabilities. So things like chronic illness or pain, or and part of mine is my disability is chronic fatigue. And people don't believe that, and people only want to celebrate those people who somehow overcome different aspects or recover. And that's not all of us, and we can still live wonderful and beautiful lives despite that, and lives that are extremely valuable and interconnected with disabled and non-disabled people alike.
We're talking to Alice Wong and Amanda Riom about the new anthology, Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a disability and a story to share with us? What would you like people to know? What are you thinking about on the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act? Are there issues of access or of discrimination that still need to be solved? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Alice Wong, editor of the new book Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century. Amanda Riom is also with us, one of the contributors to that anthology. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a book, a movie, or other media about and by people with disabilities you'd like to recommend? Or do you have questions for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alice, one thing that struck me about a lot of the essays is that people are expressing the joy they take in their lives. It's not just about the obstacles and challenges. It's not in any way a request for pity from other people, whether it's, I think, a Muslim person with cerebral palsy talking about the joy of fasting during Ramadan, as tough as that can be, or stories of creativity or embracing community. Can you talk about the importance of that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't separate all of the joys and brilliance and innovation and all of the beauty that comes from having a being disabled. And I think, you know, this sounds very, to the non-disabled people in the audience, they may be shocked, you know, they may be kind of surprised that there is joy. And I think, you know, this is not to gloss over the very real, you know, challenges, but I would also say that, you know, there is so much brilliance. There's so much just culture that's created by disabled people. And this is very much, I think, in opposition to, you know, prevailing ideas that still that disability is a problem to be fixed, and that, you know, disability is much of an individual phenomenon versus a collective movement. And that's how I really do see it. And I do hope that people become a little bit interested if they get to read this book and then discover more. In the back of my book, I do have a list of readings and resources if the people want to read more. So this is just a snapshot of 37 stories that I personally think are powerful, personal, and very political. And I really hope this gets people excited and curious.
And Amanda, as a creative person before your disability and now still after it, can you talk about the importance of, for you and the other contributors in this book, all very creative people, of expressing that creative side, sharing it, and other people paying attention to the creative works by people with disabilities?
Yeah, I think for me, it was interesting. When I was injured right afterwards, I told people I wouldn't write about my injury. That there were so many stories about people recovering from injuries. But disability changed my life, and it changed my life in part because of the ableism I experienced. So many people don't understand disability who are non-disabled, and they treat disabled people in really horrific and horrendous ways, in ways that in the first couple of years after my disability, I literally had to cut most of my former friends and even some family members out of my life because they couldn't figure out how to understand what I was going through and even just believe me when I was in pain. The idea that we don't believe people who have invisible disabilities, or we don't believe people who have disabilities, or the rhetoric in which we think there is no such thing as disabled joy, or where we bring suspicion and doubt to people who say that they're disabled or have chronic illness. These are really, really painful narratives to the disabled community, and they are very harmful. One of the things that I think is important and about writing about disability and why I write about it is to articulate the way in which that ableism harms. And that's actually, I write in this piece, I write a lot about the joy, but there's a pain in this story too. The reason why Maddie and I connected so much was because we were the first people who could understand what it was like to go who could understand what it was like to go through that. We became disabled and were surrounded by family members and friends who didn't understand and treated us in just horrific ways because they didn't understand. And so what I'm so happy about in seeing more work by disabled writers getting more visibility is that hopefully people will listen to that and they'll take some time to understand the way marginalization and oppression and the toxic narratives that we have about disability are causing very real harms interpersonally to disabled people, but also systemically by the way that we exclude disabled people from employment, in the ways that we deal with them in regards to social services. Disabled people often don't get enough funding in order to, like, who aren't able to work don't get funding in order to cover their basic needs. And this is terrible. This is horrible. This is a tragedy. And reading about disabled people and their lives, it's my hope that people who are disabled will feel a kinship in that pain and feel like they're not alone, but then also people who are non-disabled will maybe think a bit about how they've been acting and the ways in which marginalization and oppression occur around disabled people, especially those with intersecting marginalizations, as you were saying earlier, and change both interpersonally and our structures.
I want to bring on a caller now. Ellen is with us in Cedarburg. Ellen, hello.
Hi, I'm calling just to thank the two ladies for their work. I guess I have what could be called an invisible disability of the psychological depression and anxiety throughout my life, and it really has always been a struggle to feel like I'm of any kind of value or any kind of success. And the people that I found that helped me were other people with these types of disabilities, especially a group called the Grand Avenue Club here in Milwaukee. And I just found, I found that people have incredible beauty and strength. And I just want to thank these two ladies for showing us that.
Ellen, thank you so much for the call. Alice, Ellen kind of illustrates what you were saying earlier about the importance of hearing stories from other people with similar life situations, with similar, and in this case, struggles with depression for Ellen. In our last minute or so, Alice, talk about your hopes a little more for what comes out of this book and the stories in it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this, Ellen. You know, I really do hope that for the disabled readers of this book, that they feel seen and heard, that they realize that they are enough, and you know, any kind of feeling of just, you know, there's power in connecting with one another. And whether it's through friends, or peers, or groups, there is real power when we are able to really tell our truths and share it with the world. So I just want to thank you for sharing your story with us, Ellen, and, you know, for everybody who's out there who is ready or not ready yet to be part of the disability community. I just do hope that people know that you are enough and that you are welcome and, you know, we're here. And I think that's all. I'll just end it like that.
It's a great place to end it. Alice, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rob.
And Amanda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Alice Wong is editor of the new anthology called Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. She's also founder and director of the Disability Visibility Project. Also with us, Amanda Riome, a writer with a disability who is one of the essayists contributing to that book. Coming up, we'll take a look at mask mandates in cities and counties around the state and take a look at the growing number of COVID-19 cases statewide and nationwide. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, find out how the world of college sports is trying to figure out how to deal with the fall season as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Dane County and the city of Milwaukee have new mask mandates as the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases grow in Wisconsin. Green Bay is also considering a similar rule to slow the spread of the virus. The number of Wisconsin's new daily COVID-19 cases hit an all-time high, marking the fourth time in a week that the daily case numbers have broken records. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported more than 960 new cases of the virus today. Our next guest joins us to talk about the increasing number of cases, what the mask mandate could do, and how people can stay safe and social as the outbreak continues. Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back, Rob. Thanks.
Dr. Remington, first of all, looking at the latest numbers and trends here in the state, how are we doing?
Well, what we've learned in this pandemic is that the numbers don't lie, that the number of people being diagnosed with COVID-19 is directly related to the risk behaviors, how many people are coming into contact with infected persons. And the more that happens, whether it's in social gatherings in bars or restaurants or people gathering with friends and family, no matter how it happens, we now are getting to close to 1,000 cases being diagnosed every day. So it's a real evidence-based scientific marker for what the risk behaviors are. And it shows that since March, April, and May, we've now loosened up. People are spending more time with other people. People are practicing less safe habits. And that's just leading to more cases being diagnosed.
From what we know now, what kind of situations would you avoid? What strikes you as the biggest risk of a big spreading event right about now?
Well, I think there are two ends to that spectrum. There's the end where, as Senator Johnson said, mass quarantine, where everybody is staying at home. And we know that's effective. Some countries have used that strategy to basically wipe out transmission. If we in Wisconsin could somehow do that and everybody would stay home for 2 weeks, we would see no cases being reported because they would circulate within family groups and then there'd be no transmission. But we know that's not possible. The other end of the spectrum is if you go to high-risk settings, mass gatherings, places that are indoors, places where people are shouting or screaming or singing, and very close contact, not just, you know, 5.5 feet, but being right next to people and crowded, packed in. Those places, I think with 1,000 cases being reported, the prevalence might be in a community up to 5 or 10%, that you have a gathering of 100 people, you can pretty much bet on it that you're going to have somebody who may not be symptomatic, but they may be spreading the virus. And the final thing is, if those places, there are few or no people wearing masks, then you're truly in a high-risk situation.
That brings us to the masks. And I just read a piece by a doctor writing in the Washington Post looking for some silver linings here when it comes to COVID-19. And he found a few. And one was, we know something that works, and that something is masks. If we got more serious about wearing our masks, and now we've got mask mandates in a couple communities in the state, does that really make a difference?
Absolutely. You know, we've been learning as we go. I remember our first conversation in February, mm-hmm. and we talked about, you know, whether the state had the ability to use isolation and quarantine. And as we've gone along, we've learned a lot about this virus, about its pathology and epidemiology. And one thing we've learned is that a mask prevents the virus from coming out of your mouth if you're ill or even if you're infected but not symptomatic. And that's a way to prevent others from getting sick should you be in the same room or close by. And there's great studies on the effectiveness of that, the type of mask. But most masks, no matter whether they're cloth masks or, disposable masks, prevent a vast majority of the water droplets that potentially could have virus from going into the air. So wearing a mask is a simple an effective strategy to prevent someone who's ill or infected but not symptomatic from getting others sick. And I think we're in the position now with this serious illness that everyone should be wearing masks when they're indoors or closer than 6 feet to people, because you just don't know. Of those 960 people diagnosed today, I imagine very few of them knew they were going to have a positive test. They may have been suspicious that they engaged in a gathering that they should not have. But most people, I bet, are surprised when that comes back. And now they have to deal with the downstream consequences. For many people, this is going to be a serious illness. Fatality rates among older people as high as 10 or 20%. And potential long-term health effects. So again, even if you feel well, if you're going to be in an indoor environment, or if you're going to be closer than 6 feet to somebody, wear a mask. It's the best thing that you can do to protect the health of others.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, getting the latest on COVID-19, mask use, how we're doing in the state and the nation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Maybe your thoughts. Again, 800-642-1234. Dr. Remington, a concern we see out there is that, you know, we're north of 130,000 people in the U.S. dead from this, and people still not taking it seriously. A story that I assumed actually was a hoax story turned out to be true in San Antonio. A doctor talking about a 30-year-old patient who died at the hospital saying he had thought this was a hoax. He went to a COVID-19 party with somebody who had been tested positive to see if this thing was real. He's dead. Now, a lot of people treating this thing as a hoax, apparently. Still, how can we get people to take this thing more seriously?
Well, I wish everybody would listen to Central Time and Wisconsin Public Radio, but unfortunately, that's not the case. I think we as a society need to help inform each other about the facts. And if you see somebody on social media putting out some information that's frankly wrong. It's hard to contradict people. It might be better not to do it publicly on Facebook or on a social media platform. But I think it's the best thing that we can do is a phone call to say, you know, that information you put out is frankly not correct. That, you know, the best evidence is that masks don't cause disease. They actually prevent disease from being transmitted. Or that, you know, being 10 feet away outdoors is not a high risk setting. That's actually a low risk setting, because I think there's wrong information. There's misinformation on both sides. There are people who, when they see people sitting 10 feet apart outdoors, that they're worried that they're going to transmit COVID-19 to each other. And that's simply not the case. That's a very low risk setting.
That's a great point that this isn't just about the don'ts, but the things that we know still are pretty safe to do. Is it important to emphasize the things we can do safely and that this isn't all just about, you know, the sacrifice and the negative?
I think it's a great point. I think that, don't messages, negative messages don't resonate very well, particularly with young people. I think we should be encouraging outdoor activity. I think we should be encouraging social gathering, not just on Zoom and other social media platforms, but outdoors. If you can maintain safe physical distancing or the occasion when you might wear a mask, a gathering outdoors is a safe activity. I think if we're having a recommendation of basically universal quarantine, that people will not accept that. And that's frankly not viable for the economy. It's not necessary for public health. We just have to figure out how to be smart as individuals and as a society about how to define what a low risk social gathering would be, and then how to keep our behaviors in that realm, in the realm of getting together, but wearing masks whenever you're going to be close by to somebody, but preferably maintaining physical distancing. And you can already see it. You see people eating outdoors. You see people gathering in backyards, and tables are larger than they used to be. People are setting their chairs far away. And that, to me, should be promoted. That should be a positive statement. But get together, but do so safely.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington right now, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's looking at the latest news regarding the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and initiatives in some cities and counties around the state to try to slow the spread of the virus, including a couple of mask mandates, maybe more on the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19 and the coronavirus that causes it? What do you want to know about masks and how they work? If you're getting cabin fever, what questions do you have about what you can do safely? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue our conversation about the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And with you, if you'd like to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the COVID-19 pandemic? What do you want to know about the use of masks? If you're curious about how to see your friends and maintain social physical distancing, is it safe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Monique is with us in Milwaukee. Monique, hello.
Good afternoon. I just had a question with regards to, more people are wearing masks, and we've been a little bit warmer than usual, and I've been noticing some people are sweating, and I think with the mask on, that makes them sweat a little bit more. Are those droplets from that sweat a concern?
Interesting. Sweat, Dr. Yeah. Remington, does it spread via sweat?
It does not. Those particles come out of your lungs, and they're respiratory particles. Most of them are quite large. They're droplets, and they don't go very far, and that's the benefit of the mask. I did see a review, I think it was either New York Times or Washington Post, where somebody who was exercising reviewed different masks, and they find those neck sort of neck tubes that are quite thin but very easy to breathe through are both effective in preventing the droplets from going out, but more sort of easier for exercise. So I would just go online, and I'm sure you can find information. People are promoting sort of masks that are better for people who are engaging in physical activity. I have seen people who are riding a bike or running, and they're miles away from others and wearing a mask. And although that might make you feel more comfortable, or I should say confident, and it might help you habituate to mask wearing, it's really not necessary. If you are not close to somebody and you can exercise away from people, you do not need a mask. And I think that will help. And so the best thing to do would be to exercise far away from people, and then you do not need a mask.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Amber now in Green Bay. Amber, hello.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about some activity that my sister's family has had and what risk level you would say it's at. So they took a road trip to Yellowstone, and it sounds like they were pretty safe as far as, like, they didn't go out to dinner. They brought food in a cooler. They would maybe stop at a grocery store to pick things up. They kept most of their activities outside and sounds like distance from other people. However, they went on a whitewater rafting trip with probably about 8 other people that we have no idea where they came from or who they've had contact with or anything about them. So they were on a raft for an extended amount of time with probably about 8 other people. Now, it's outdoors, but that's still pretty close proximity. What would you consider the risk for something like that?
Well, it's always hard to say, because risk for an individual either turns out to be they're infected or they're not. But it sounds to me like they were being pretty diligent about avoiding being closer than 6 feet to people. And they've done everything they could. Now, it could be that they just were unlucky and got in a raft with somebody who was putting out a lot of virus. But I think the fact that that's outdoors, that's not a great way to transmit virus. Indoors, close to people, poor ventilation is the high-risk environment. Outdoors, wind-blowing sun, the virus doesn't do well. It immediately dilutes in the air, and so I think that's a low-risk situation. But if you add up a bunch of low-risk situations, then eventually it's going to catch up to you. The other question is, how long has it been since that exposure? Because the typical incubation period is about 5 days. And if it's an entire family and now they're 10 days after that and nobody's ill, I think it makes it even more likely that they were engaged in pretty safe activity. But again, if they have to know if they're going to come in contact with an older person, they could go into their community testing center just to make sure.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us talking about COVID-19. Before I go back to our callers, that reminds me, there was a hope in the spring that as things warmed up and we got out in the sun, that was going to help slow transmission. But we're seeing Arizona, Texas, Florida, other really warm states where people are inside in air conditioning a lot. Presumably, things are really accelerating in places like that. Exactly the opposite of what we hoped for the summer, Dr. Remington.
Well, that's why this has been frustrating, I think, for people in the information business, is that just when you think you know something about a virus, that viruses tend to be seasonal, tend to peak in the winter and go down in the summer. We hope that would be the case. But what we've learned for COVID-19 is that is not the case. So it could, however, be the case that as we go to winter, what we actually find is it gets worse, that it's bad now. It could get worse as we go indoors. And I think the take-home message that I'm wanting people to hear now is that we are in this for the long run. We had hoped a couple of months ago that it would die down in the summer, things would go back to normal in the fall. We're not talking months now. We're talking years. 99% of people in the state of Wisconsin are susceptible, even with more than 40,000 diagnosed cases. Maybe there's 100,000 people infected. Most people are susceptible. And as long as we have susceptible people gathering in common places, we're going to see transmission. So I think the things we're talking about need to be new normative behaviors, new norms about mask wearing, about social distancing, about taking things outdoors if you can, and avoiding those high-risk situations.
Thanks a lot for your call. Sheila joins us now in Boscobel. Sheila, hi.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering, and thank you for taking my call. What do you about people, if they make it 100% mandatory to wear a mask, what about people like me that can't? I'm claustrophobic. I've tried. I have panic attacks as soon as it gets near my face.
Sheila, well, sorry to hear that. Thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, sorry, go ahead.
I think there are exceptions to most rules and laws, and I would make, obviously, I don't think there are going to be any people out doing mask policing and enforcing this. I think it's important, though, for other people to realize that they're, that it's not that you're not wearing a mask because you don't care about them. It's because it's difficult for you to do. You could then avoid places like going shopping indoors or going other to other indoor environments and just ask somebody else to do that for you so that you avoid those settings when others might be looking at you and saying, you know, you need to be wearing a mask. So I would, if you, if it's possible, again, stay 6 feet away and stay outdoors and you don't need a mask. But if you're going indoors or you're getting closer than 6 feet, masks are effective. And again, they're not an absolute for everybody. There are people who have exceptions. But I would just avoid those settings where you feel it's necessary.
And that, thanks for that call and good luck. That reminds me, Dane County specifically said, okay, yes, mask mandate. No, please don't call the police if you see somebody not wearing a mask. Please don't police them yourselves. And I think that's probably pretty good advice on masks in general. Like, wear them, but don't feel like you have to be the mask cop in public.
Yeah, many public health laws, one of the challenges is enforcement. How do you possibly police people smoking indoors in restaurants or bars? That was always the concern. If you ban smoking, who's going to police that? It turns out once that becomes a norm, it's pretty much self-policing. People sort of self-police that you're not going to light up a cigarette in a restaurant or a bar now. I think the mask mandate will be self-policed, but she makes a very good point, is that if there are good reasons for you not to wear a mask, then I think there may be people who are going to say something, because it could be that you're making a statement that I don't believe that it's my responsibility to protect your health. And that could make somebody upset. And so I think it's important to avoid those settings where you might otherwise need a mask.
Thanks a lot for all of your calls. Just a minute or so left, Dr. Remington. Leave us with some parting thoughts and advice for our listeners.
Well, I think the good news is that we know things work. We know that wearing a mask reduces the transmission to others very well. It's a very low cost, safe, effective intervention. And I've come to now have masks pretty much in every car, in my pockets, and I am a universal mask wearer when I'm indoors or closer than 6 feet to others. We've learned about hand hygiene, and that's not, you don't hear that emphasized as much. It turns out we don't see as much transmission from surfaces as we thought we might. And finally, we really know what the high-risk settings are. Of these 960 new cases, I bet when the contact tracers track them down, they will find that they were indoors, that they were close to other people, that they went to a party thinking, you know, just this time once, or maybe everybody here is safe. And so avoid those high-risk situations and do all the things, wear masks and keep socially distant and stay outdoors if you can. We know that that'll work.
Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to give us an update on the COVID-19 pandemic and on statewide health initiatives to combat the spread of the virus. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new U.S. Supreme Court decision allows states to lock in their electors in presidential balloting. We'll find out what that decision means for efforts to reform the Electoral College. In our weekly look at the latest news in national politics, we'll check out the president's decision to commute the sentence of his longtime advisor, Roger Stone. And some sports are getting ready to play ball in Wisconsin. We'll get the latest on Brewers games and some other big events. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 8, as the United States reckons with centuries of racial inequality, Kate's guest says we can learn from truth and reconciliation efforts in South Africa. Find out more tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at three of Wisconsin's most Republican-leaning counties and what they may tell us about the upcoming 2020 election. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.